This week on The Right Side, Stephen Mandel is running for Alberta Party leadership. Unlikely allies want to keep BC's current political system, and many middle-class Canadians are actually paying more in taxes. Meanwhile, Trudeau's town halls allow the CBC to change the narrative. This is The Right Side, episode 51, recorded Saturday, January 13th, 2018, Changing the Narrative. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for what is the second episode of The Right Side in 2018. Patrick and myself are back this week, as we are each and every week. Welcome back.
It's good to be back and good to have lots to talk about this week, as we always do, it seems.
Oh, yeah, lots to talk about that isn't being talked about, that should be being talked about, and lots of misplaced narrative in numerous areas, but we'll get to that in just a wee bit. But if you guys are joining us for the first time, The Right Side is a podcast, and you know we're based out of Edmonton and Victoria, and our job here is to cut through the bias and sensationalism that you hear in the mainstream media and, you know, talk about what should actually be being talked about in these stories and what the missed opportunities are. So that's what we do each and every week here at The Right Side. And if you're interested in following along, you can find full show notes for this episode at rightsidenews.ca. So you ready to begin?
I am all set. Let's go.
All right.
What do you have for us first?
So the first story here comes from Alberta. And, you know, this is something that has been long suspected, but, you know, people were unsure if it was going to happen. Stephen Mandel has confirmed that he is running to be leader of the Alberta Party. And, you know, this followed much speculation and cryptic tweets from Stephen Mandel, but he did eventually enter the race this week. So for those of you guys who might not be aware of Stephen Mandel, if you live outside of Edmonton or outside of Alberta, he's the former mayor of Edmonton and was in office from October 2004 through October 2013. He was also the last progressive health or progressive conservative health minister under Premier Jim Prentice. So we'll talk a bit more about why that's important in just a little bit. But first, a little bit of background on the Alberta Party. So the Alberta Party was first founded in 1985, believe it or not, but gained little traction throughout the years leading up to the 2015 Alberta election. In 2015, the party reoriented itself as a centrist political option aiming to be fiscally responsible, yet socially progressive and do politics differently. In 2015, the Alberta Party elected its first MLA in a general election with Greg Clark, who was the leader at that time. And since then, the Alberta Party has played a relatively minor role, with Greg Clark being its lone MP for the longest time. On October 29th, 2017, Karen McPherson from the NDP crossed the floor to join the Alberta Party. And on January 9th of this year, Rick Fraser, former UCP MLA and former Progressive Conservative MLA, crossed the floor to sit in the Alberta Party caucus as well. So the Alberta Party leadership race has been relatively quiet so far, with only a few candidates showing interest. There are currently four candidates running for this leadership race that concludes on February 27th of this year. They are Jacob Huffman, who is a University of Calgary student involved with the Alberta Liberals, Kara Levy, who is a Calgary-based energy lawyer, Rick Fraser, who is the Calgary Southeast MLA since 2012, who also sat in Alison Redford's cabinet, and later joined the UCP before leaving to join the Alberta Party earlier this month. And of course, the story of the week that everyone should be talking about and that we're talking about right now is former Edmonton Mayor Stephen Mandel and former Progressive Conservative Health Minister. So, in his lead-up to join this race, Stephen Mandel issued a series of cryptic tweets leading up to his declaration, with various Alberta landmarks being placed upside down in the tweets. And as we found out, this showed to the people during his nomination speech, I guess you could say, that he views the province as currently on the wrong track in a way that it's upside down from the way it should be, and that's what he wants to correct if he successfully captures the leadership of the Alberta Party. Now, this really wasn't talked about all that much in the mainstream media because they went towards other news items this week, but this is perhaps the largest political event in Alberta since Jason Kenney's election as leader of the United Conservative Party this past October. It should have been talked about more, but quite frankly, it wasn't. And, you know, it was largely glossed over for a draft policy put out by a couple of United Conservative Party staffers that called for, firstly, the abolition of the carbon tax in Alberta, and secondly, a return to Alberta's flat rate tax, which we had during the former Progressive Conservative government. But that's a topic for another show. Recall also that the UCP's official policy convention will be this spring in Red Deer, and until then, anything put forward by the party are merely suggestions as ways they could go. Now, the NDP were outraged at such a plan, stating that it would only benefit the rich and, you know, it would be reckless in a time of deficit, and the UCP agrees with this latter point. And the reason the NDP feel this way is because if you look at the current taxation structure in Alberta, anyone making less than $126,000 a year still pays that 10% taxation point, but the median income in Fort McMurray is somewhere around $108,000 a year. So you can see where there are parts of the province where a return to the flat rate tax would benefit a good number of people there. But as I said, we'll probably get to that later in the spring as we get closer to the policy convention. So it's not even real policy yet, but here we have the NDP on defense and the media is covering their defense of this when on the other side here in Edmonton, you have Stephen Mandel throwing his hat in the ring to become leader of the Alberta Party. And this is a pretty big deal because the Alberta Party is a centrist option. And that could really hurt the NDP in Calgary and in Edmonton as well. And that's something that really hasn't been talked about in the mainstream media this week. So this is a huge decision for Stephen Mandel to enter this race, and it has the potential to change the trajectory of that party. And with something so massive potentially on the horizon, one would think we would see more coverage on this.
If the Alberta Party kind of comes out as a credible centrist option, there's probably a lot of people in the last election that voted for the NDP that are probably closer to the center and would rather vote for like a rejuvenated Alberta Party rather than stick with the NDP. So if they come out, that's going to also take votes away from the NDP, especially in the in their strongholds, basically, in the bigger cities. So that's where the NDP are counting on a lot of their votes to come in the next election. And if the Alberta siphons some of those away, it's going to create some very interesting three-way races, right?
Exactly. And that's a part of this coverage that is sorely missed here, is because anyone who sees what the Alberta Party stands for would see the potential for that to happen. But also with this, we're seeing the downsides of the lack of coverage of Stephen Mandel joining the race, because he was mayor for a long time and oversaw a lot of projects. And two of those were the 23rd Avenue interchange on the south side of Edmonton. This project initially had a completion date of 2006, so he oversaw at least 2 years of its construction. But it was pushed all the way back to 2011, the total completion of it, and it also came in over budget. Finally, while running for what claims to be a fiscally responsible party, the Alberta Party, Stephen Mandel as mayor and his council also negotiated a horrible deal with Darrell Case to build the new Rogers Place hockey arena for the Edmonton Oilers in downtown Edmonton. This project was initially budgeted to come in at roughly $480 million, but later expanded to almost $605 million. $279 million for this project eventually came from the City of Edmonton via the Community Revitalization Levy, which is a pool of resources set aside for revitalizing poorer areas of the city. $125 million from this also came from the ticket surcharge that you pay if you go to an event at Rogers Place, and $137 million came from lease revenue at the arena, while $23.68 million was chipped in from the Edmonton Arena Corporation, which is effectively Darrell Cates, and $25 million came from other levels of government. So this ultimately means that Darrell Cates' group paid for roughly $162 million of the arena, while he can still profit off it. And this is horrible fiscal oversight of Mandel and his council for basically having the taxpayers fund a good portion of this building that will allow Darrell Cates to continue to profit off of it. The arena deal also has effectively caused the shutdown and massive downsizing of Northlands, which is a group in Edmonton that used to run the Edmonton Coliseum and Rexall Place that has existed since 1879. So these are questions that could be brought up when it comes to Mandel's previous fiscal discipline, but none of this has been talked about during this week. There's also been zero deep analysis of Mandel with respect to the Alberta Party leadership race and where that party is going to be going in the future. And what's more with this is that at Mandel's launch event, we saw Catherine O'Neill, who was the last president of the Alberta Progressive Conservative Party. So with Rick Fraser joining the race, who is in Alison Redford's cabinet, there's definitely going to be a lot of influence going on in this race from the former Progressive Conservative Party. So when the Alberta Party rebranded itself in 2010, there was a huge emphasis on doing politics differently and almost being apolitical in a way and focusing more on policy than politics, so to speak. But with this much former influence from the Progressive Conservative Party, it almost feels like it's becoming Progressive Conservative Party 2.0 or Progressive Conservatives circa 2018. And also, missed in this week's reporting, was the NDP mocking Stephen Mandel's tweet and his tweets and his cancellation of the Calgary Cancer Centre during his time as PC Health Minister. And the reason this was seen as insensitive by many and the NDP eventually removed the tweets is because recently Mandel's daughter passed away due to lymphoma. So as we can see here, there's at least three different avenues that this could have been talked about this week relating to the way that this could potentially reshape Alberta's political landscape once again, but it was largely glossed over by the media to cover the NDP's defense of a policy suggestion that may not actually become policy this spring.
Yeah, especially considering that the UCP aren't even in government right now, so that means that anything they come up with until the election it really shouldn't be that big of news, and it shouldn't be taking precedent over something like this, where this has a huge impact on Alberta politics in the future, especially if Mandel wins the election and is able to revitalize the Alberta Party and gain a few seats here and there. We've seen this in BC, where a very small party can gain just 3 seats, and yet that decides the future of the government. So who knows if this would happen in Alberta as well, but that could make a huge difference in how politics would happen after the next election, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, especially when it comes down to fiscal responsibility, looking at the capital projects in Edmonton, the interchange and the arena deal, combined with the former Progressive Conservative influence on that party. And, you would think that that would be something that would want to be talked about more. But it's all largely been glossed over this week, unfortunately. So, honestly, I think Stephen Mandel deserved more attention than he ended up getting this week. So,
and more attention, bad or good, I suppose.
Exactly. It doesn't need to be good or it doesn't need to be bad necessarily, just more attention on the whole. So,
yeah, they just need to start the conversation, basically. And that's ultimately what the media is supposed to be for, isn't it? Is to be able to start the conversation, present the facts the way it is. Go into a bit of the history for people who don't know him, and then talk about it and see how that's going to happen. And
right.
That's basically what you did just there with that article there. You're probably doing a better job than most of the media who are paid
right,
to
because
do this.
If you look at someone in Lloydminster or Fort McMurray or even Calgary, they're not going to know specifically about what Mandel did as his time as mayor of Edmonton. So that's something the media needs to jump on and bring to the forefront here. So what do you got for us in BC this week?
All right, so in BC we've actually got kind of similar to Alberta in which the newspapers and the media, they're not really talking about anything political at all this week. And the only story that actually came out that was actually any worthy to be able to talk about was a very interesting story where a lot of people from different parties are actually working together against the NDP's attempts to push the electoral reform through. And it's very, you'd think it would be very unlikely that former BC NDP and former BC Liberals would work together ever on anything, but it appears that that's actually the case. So back on episodes 37 and 40, I discussed the referendum on proportional representation that's going to happen this upcoming November and how it was going to work. But if you really want the Coles Notes version of it, basically it's just a straight 50% plus one vote with no turnout threshold. And I've detailed how proportional representation would actually concentrate power in the lower mainland and weaken the representation of all other areas in BC. And now it seems that the unlikely allies have actually banded together to fight the referendum. They include Bill Tielemann, who is a former BC NDP strategist, Susan Anton, who is a former BC Liberal MLA and the former Liberal Attorney General, and Bob Plakis, who is a former deputy minister under Social Credit and NDP in the 80s and 90s. And they actually announced Wednesday that they were all joining together to form a group, which is the No BC Proportional Representation Society, to campaign for the No side in the upcoming referendum on switching BC's voting system. Now, Tielemann, Anton, and Plakis want their group to become the official proponent for the No side of the issue, which, according to the Electoral Referendum or Reform Referendum Act of 2018, could entitle them to public funds to make their case. Now, all three have said in a sentence, in a statement, that a switch to proportional representation would actually empower party bosses and make government less accountable. And much like I said in earlier episodes, they also feel it could hurt rural voters and allow extremist parties to rise. Tielemann said, "It's a bad system. It's a system that really doesn't work in many, many places it's been used." And Anton says it's actually quite telling that federal liberals abandoned the plan to adopt proportional representation as well. She says, quote, "Right now we've got an easy system. It's very easy to understand. What works well is a stable parliamentary democracy that we have in Canada and that we have in BC. There's no reason to mess with our electoral system." Now, the most experienced leader of this No side is Tielemann. He actually played a leadership role in the successful No campaigns in the 2005 and 2009 referendums on the single transferable vote version of proportional representation. And he was also a part of the No side in the 2011 ballot by mail referendum on the harmonized sales tax, which ended up canceling out that and eventually led to Premier Gordon Campbell resigning. Now, his record notwithstanding, Tielemann actually concedes that this will probably be the toughest fight yet for him. Now, the NDP have lowered the threshold for approval of the change, and Premier John Horgan is actually personally making the case for reform. During the campaign last year, Horgan vowed to get citizens to embrace proportional representation, and in the course of an interview, he actually expressed his hopes of bringing maybe even Bill Tielemann on his side. So it's actually clear that when you put politics aside, Tielemann is a strong voice in BC, and that he's very influential in getting results. Now, Tielemann speaks for New Democrats who fret that the abandonment of the current first-past-the-post system means that the NDP will never form another majority government. Now, for the times that the NDP have actually won majorities, if those same elections were held under proportional representation, they would have actually been defeated by a coalition of parties further to the center and the center-right. So this is something that advocates for the switch have actually been talking about, is that there's an assumption that proportional representation would guarantee another NDP green majority. But in most BC elections in modern times, including the 3-1 outright by the NDP, the majority of votes were actually cast for parties on the center-right rather than the center-left. And Vaughn Palmer, actually, of the Vancouver Sun, notes that it's funny how supporters of reform purport that the new system would be better at getting parties to work together, yet here we have, much to their dismay, a coalition on the no side from all stripes that's working together to keep the current system. And that's something that hasn't really been talked about very much, is just the idea of electoral reform in general. It doesn't seem to be on the radar of any mainstream news outlets other than in their political science section or politics section and under certain columnists. And it's not really been talked about in the media whatsoever. And something that's been going on in BC where hardly anything has been talked about. I guess everyone still has a new Christmas or New Year's hangover, but that seems to be what's the case right now.
And, you know, if you look at any political entity in Canada that has official party status, let's just say, they are within range at some point in history of forming government. I think there was a point during the last federal election where people thought Thomas Mulcair could potentially form a government in the 2015 federal election. And that is the reason why, even if parties campaign on reforming the political system to be proportional representation or some other format, that inevitably gets swept away because they see how easy it is to govern with a large majority without a majority of the votes. Whereas, you know, if they were to have less than 50% of the votes on their side, they would likely be facing a coalition of other stripes, as you said, which probably isn't what they want. So I'm wondering who is left that actually wants proportional representation inside the governing NDP in BC. Do we have any ideas on that?
Well, we know that Horgan has publicly campaigned on this before. And I think that, you know, politics aside, I think that he definitely wants the system to be changed because he believes that that's actually a better case for having the NDP in power if they can get, say, the Green Party to back them up, because the Greens are actually fairly underrepresented for their how many votes that they have. So they feel that if they can work together, that they'll have those two, that basically the center-left kind of locked in there, and they feel that that would be the case, but they're forgetting that there's a lot of people that voted for the Greens in the last election kind of as a protest vote,
right?
They would have normally voted
right
for the Liberals or another center left party. So it's kind of the same thing in Alberta, where we have the Alberta Party that could be a bit of a spoiler, but there was a lot of people that voted NDP last election that definitely wouldn't this time, and I'm fairly certain there's a lot of people in BC that voted NDP or Greens that definitely won't again. So even then, we can't really take like past statistics and kind of try and predict the future, because in elections, anything can happen. I mean, you never really know what's going
exactly
to happen until it does.
And that's one of the big issues with polls as well.
That's true. So I think it's very clear that the Green Party for sure definitely wants proportional representation, being the third party in BC. But it's hard to know if the New Democrats actually want this or not, because there's been a lot of former New Democrats that say they don't actually want this because they're on the center left, right? And they don't want, say, a further to the right party than the BC Liberals to jump up. Say the BC Liberal coalition dissolves and they end up becoming a Liberal and a Conservative Party, that Conservative Party would have views that the NDP wouldn't want, and they'd actually have more political power because of that. So there's actually a lot of NDPers that really don't want the system to change whatsoever,
yeah,
because they feel that they could actually have a better chance,
right,
of governing.
They just have to look back to the 90s and see that.
Exactly, because that was where they won their majorities, but they only won them with like 40% of the vote, just as Trudeau did federally, just as Harper did federally, just as the BC Liberals did. So, I mean, that's just how the system works. Now, it's very hard to find an election where the governing party actually won over 50% of the vote in elections, usually. I mean, Alberta is probably the exception for this in past times, but it's something that's not really been talked about in the media very much. Not the election, not the electoral reform, not the possibilities, not what would happen. And it's like we said before with the Alberta, it's the media's job to start the conversation, and they haven't really done very much on that. There's been a couple articles over the past month on this, and that's really not enough, I think, when it comes down to it.
Indeed. Last Alberta election to be won with more than 50% of the vote, Alberta 2001, Ralph Klein won with 61.9% of the vote.
There you go. I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find a federal election when they were over 50% of the vote, for sure.
Yeah.
You'd have to go back to at least not in this century.
Definitely. All right. Well, that takes us nicely into Canada here. And there was a little opinion piece in the Toronto Sun by Lauren Gunter that says, so much for Trudeau's pledge. Middle-class families now actually pay more taxes. And the whole premise of this opinion piece is based on a new report from the Fraser Institute. And let's just think here for a moment and realize that people are going to notice when they have more money in their pockets that they can spend on their families and that they can spend on their own personal investments. Everyone appreciates having more disposable income. So the 2015 general election, you know, that culminated in Justin Trudeau winning was primarily focused on his part of improving the lives of the middle class and increasing the amount of money that they had in their pockets. But recently, according to the Fraser Institute, 81% of middle-class families in Canada are paying higher federal taxes now than they were under the previous Conservative government. On average, according to the Fraser Institute, this amounts to an increase of roughly $840 more per year. $840. So while the government can say that they lowered taxes on people making between $45,000 a year and $91,000 a year, they also eliminated a series of tax credits which accounted for most of this tax increase. The only income bracket where a majority of families are not paying higher income taxes today is the bracket from $1 to $51,598. This means that for a family making more than $51,699, there is a good chance that more than half of them, in fact, north of 65% of these people, will ultimately be paying more taxes today than they were before the 2015 election. And the all-telling figure in this is that the middle class bracket from $77,000 to $107,000 a year, 81% of these people are paying higher taxes under the current tax plan. And in the media, even after the election, we saw numerous montages of Trudeau using his favorite moniker, the middle class, and highlighting how much better they will be doing under his plan, and that is the whole purpose of his government. But we need to really ask the question, is paying $840 more per year on taxes really doing better in the grand scheme of things in Canada? I think the number speaks for itself here. So while the tax cut was delivered early on in the mandate, we need to look ahead to what's coming. And there's the carbon tax at the federal level that will be requiring provinces to implement their own version of that tax. There's also the increasing tax burden that municipalities put on their families in order to fund their programs and services locally. So in reality, unless there's some undocumented tax cut on the horizon, then tax rates in Canada will ultimately continue to increase under this government. And the Fraser Institute report here is also telling because it wasn't necessarily talked about in many places aside from this opinion piece in the Toronto Sun. And I think we can all attest that whenever the government does something big when it comes to fiscal policy, you know, raising interest rates or maybe a new budget deficit marker in this case, as we have had for the last number of years, that's always reported on in the mainstream media. But yet the simple fact that most Canadians on average are going to be paying $840 more a year wasn't reported in the national media is really quite astounding here. Because anytime people have more money in their pockets, it's ultimately good for the economy and, of course, their quality of life. So it's really quite a wonder why this wasn't talked about at all when I think if you ask anyone if they could do something more with $840 a year, the answer would be yes.
That's right. And I think it just goes to show the power of words as well when you talk about an election campaign, because we saw Trudeau using the words the middle class so many times. In fact, he still uses it quite a few times in how he lowered taxes for the middle class and raised them on the 1%. I think we hear that week after week after week just listening to politics in Ottawa. But it's very interesting how the middle class doesn't really have a specified definition. You would think that it would be basically the middle 33% of people in income when it comes to income, but in this case it's actually not. And it's very interesting how a lot of people will say they're part of the middle class when you actually look at how much they're making. They're usually part of the working poor, or even in some cases under the poverty line. So I think that's what Trudeau means when he's talking about middle class, but he's not actually using middle class correctly.
He's not using the economic definition of it, which is what the Fraser Institute uses. And, you know, when it comes down to pocketbook values, that's what the majority of Canadians use. So
that's right. And it's very interesting how in the middle class bracket, how so many more people are going to be paying more when he's trying to go out on the TV and say that the middle class is going to be paying less, when people actually look in their pockets and they say, oh, well, tax season is coming up and people are going to be paying more. They're going to think that he's basically a liar because of it. And that's going to be something that he's going to change the narrative on, basically, in how he moves forward when it comes to taxes.
Indeed, and that is, of course, something the media should also talk about as well when politicians are lying. But we do also have something else here on changing the narrative, which is going to be very interesting to watch to see how this pans out. So what do you got?
That's right. So starting 2018, you might remember that Trudeau's had a bit of a series of scandals. In if you've been listening over the past couple episodes, there's been Morneau and his troubling findings with the Ethics Commissioner. There's been Trudeau's findings with the Ethics Commissioner, where he's actually found to have been broken ethics laws, which is a first in Canadian history. There was him meeting with Joshua Boyle, who was later charged for a multitude of crimes, and so many, many more things that have been going on. So he's been trying to get out of Ottawa and trying to, you know, recraft his image, I suppose. And how he's doing that is he's going across Canada doing a series of town halls. Now, he started off in, I believe it was Lower Sackville in Nova Scotia, and then he headed to Ontario. I think it was London and Hamilton, and I believe he's going on to Winnipeg and Edmonton later in this month. So he's basically been working his way east from the east and then heading west. Now, very interesting how he's missing Quebec, he's missing BC, and he's missing a huge portion of the Ontario population. So it's very interesting just the cities that he's deciding to go to. Now, something that's been interesting about these town halls is that they're actually fairly unscripted, and people can ask the Prime Minister whatever questions they want without prior screening. And it's actually interesting how that is actually playing into the Prime Minister's hands by being able to say, oh, these are all unscripted. You can tell that we didn't vet these questions. It almost tries to make him look better in that sense, in that he's able to answer these questions even though he didn't select them, right? So he, in a sense, we have to take these town halls as not being a way to ensure democracy, as he calls it. It's basically a way to make his image better. And there's an article there from the CBC that actually starts off by explaining that politicians always earn extra credit by submitting themselves to the lion's den. And that's actually a fairly accurate way of looking at it, because he's not doing this out of the goodness of his heart. There's a reason for doing this, and it's basically to get people to not be talking about all the things that have been going on in his government. They're to get him to talk about the town halls and how he's going out and answering questions from the public. And that's very interesting how he decided to start off 2018 doing that. You know, the start of a new year where many people turn the page on 2017. They don't really want to think about it anymore, and they want to move forward. So this is how he's trying to do that. And there's actually the article headline here is Trudeau's town halls offer a masterclass in changing the narrative. And it asks the question, what better for a little reputation resuscitation than a talking to the Canadians tour? And I think that's what we've been talking about as well. So it's very interesting how that's been going on. And the article actually praises the Prime Minister, although it also indicates in his third paragraph that his answers actually, quote, invalidate that perception, with a few of them being of any real substance whatsoever. So it's interesting how a lot of his answers to his questions, just like we've heard in his public speaking over the past couple of years, they haven't really been of any substance. They haven't been real answers. A lot of them have just basically right from the script through the House of Commons and question period, almost. And a lot of people have been taking issue with that. There's been hecklers, there's been people asking very pointed questions about Cotter, about taxes, about the healthcare system, about veterans, and he's actually stumbled on a lot of the questions that he probably wasn't expecting. So it's very interesting to see how the media, and the CBC in particular, has been talking about how well Trudeau's been doing at being able to change the narrative. But in a sense, they're the ones that are changing the narrative themselves by talking about how well he's doing. When you actually just go to the video and see that on about 50% of the time, he's actually stumbling on the answers to his questions.
Yeah, and I mean, all you need to do is you just need to look and compare the House of Commons script versus the script when he's out and about. And you can see when he is off script, it's a lot less prepared. And, you know, it's interesting how the CBC can actually call that a change in narrative when, you know, 2017 ended with with the ethics commissioner issues, right?
Exactly. And then there's the failed trip to China that didn't yield any free trade agreement. There was Bill Morneau and all the problems he was going through. And the issue of the year-end fiscal updates and all the taxes that we were just talking about as well. And it's interesting how in the CBC article, they actually write that they hope that the town halls will, quote, dilute the focus, and that even if he takes a beating, his critics will have to commend him for taking this medicine, basically, in a sense that that he's trying to get, you know, remedy his sickness you know, all the scandals and whatnot that he's been going through. But I think, in a sense, I don't think we have to, because we, you know, you and I have been looking at this for quite a while this past week, and he's not doing anything different from what he normally does. He's just trying to craft his image, and that's something that the CBC seems to be lapping up here. And it's also interesting how they are talking about the opposition in a very different way. It's actually being seen as a net positive by the CBC because the opposition is still, quote, working out the kinks, to put it generously. Now, the article oddly highlights Andrew Scheer's policy on cutting funding from universities that don't stand up for freedom of speech, and yet he had his decision to remove Senator Lynn Bayek out of the Conservative caucus in the Senate. So there's been some questions about that, and there's also Jagmeet Singh, who's also not talked about very well in this piece, and they quote, having seemed to have lost the early momentum that Scheer's team never really enjoyed. Now, Jagmeet Singh's issues with answering questions about the Air India bombing and his about-face on his position regarding language requirements for judges. And basically, by talking about this in this way, they're talking about all of the opposition leaders' downfalls in the past couple months. They haven't really been talking about what they've done right. In a sense, they're trying to make it so that they're not doing very well and that Trudeau's trying to make things better by doing these town halls. And at the end of the day, it's put in the CBC article that, quote, the greenness of both party leaders will fade, but compared to Operation Trudeau, which can end 2017 muddled with scandal only to emerge with A-plus shareable content of the prime minister disarming a heckler, Trudeau will keep embracing those blows and in the long run probably be better off for it. So while people would be looking towards the news to see what Trudeau actually talked about and some substance of what the questions were asked, they're actually getting a mass grilling of the opposition by the CBC and a lot of forgiveness on the part of Justin Trudeau and his outcomes in the town halls. So that's why this story is the firing line this week, is how we showcase how the media really takes a certain narrative on how they're going to write an article about a certain topic and how they think that Trudeau is changing the narrative, but really it's the media that's doing it themselves.
You know, I saw this article in our production schedule and I just had to scratch my head with it, because How does a piece on Justin Trudeau's town hall meetings go into criticizing the opposition when the opposition has nothing to do with his town hall meetings?
Yeah, and there's been a couple CBC articles on it as well. There was also a very interesting one which compared Justin Trudeau's town hall approach to Jerry Seinfeld. Now, Seinfeld is, of course, the very popular American comedian who had one of the best-rated shows on the network in the 90s, and he talked about it how Seinfeld would basically have hecklers yelling at him, and then he'd basically go on side saying, I agree with the heckler, and basically agreeing with them and trying to solve the problem and trying to work out their anger. And he said that that basically made the audience find it funny, and it would kind of throw the heckler off approach, and because he wouldn't go against them, he'd take their side. So there was a huge article about this, how Justin Trudeau is just like Seinfeld. But when you actually watch the videos themselves, he's not really disarming the hecklers. He's basically trying to make a joke about it. When they were talking about his ethics problems, he said, what crime have I committed? And he said, oh, I don't think I've done anything wrong. And that's basically just the attitude he's had in the House of Commons as well. And that's not disarming the heckler. That's not agreeing with them or changing the narrative. That's just basically saying, I don't think I've done anything wrong, so I'm not going to answer that question.
And that's not what Canadians are going to think as well when they see the multitude of ethics issues as well. So
yeah, I can honestly say that I was watching the video of Trudeau in the town hall, and never once did I think that he sounded like Jerry Seinfeld. There's a very distinct difference between the two, that's for sure. So that was just a very bizarre article to come out about it as well. And I just thought I'd mention that because it was very interesting for one of Canada's biggest news organizations to go with that, that narrative, I suppose you could say.
Definitely. And that leads us nicely into our word of the week. But before we do that, just a bit of a correction from earlier on. It was actually Ed Stelmach in the 2008 election that last won a majority of the vote in Alberta with 52.7%. And that netted him 72 seats in the 2008 Alberta election.
Which is quite a bit.
Yeah. All right. So our word of the week is narrative. And narrative is a spoken or written account of connected events. A story, the hero of his modest narrative, or some examples here, the narrated parts of a literary work as distinct from dialogue, the practice or art of telling stories, tradition of oral narrative. I think that's something the CBC would like to get into, and a representation of a particular situation or process in such a way as to reflect or conform to an overarching set of aims or values. Example being the coalition's carefully constructed narrative about its sensitivity to recession victims. And I think that last point here quite well describes what the CBC is aiming for with these kind of articles, even though they say Trudeau is doing it, but it's actually them doing it directly to the account of that third bullet point in that definition there. And we can also talk narrative when it comes to taxes. We can talk narrative when it comes to Stephen Mandel and whether or not the Alberta Party leadership race should be covered more because it has the potential to reshape the landscape, or if the narrative on that should be the progressive conservatives having an influenced role in that party, or if it should be on his past fiscal errors or fiscal triumphs, if you like the way the arena was funded. And ultimately, I think in BC, you guys have that as well, is that there's two narratives going on about proportional representation.
That's right. And there's even the narrative which isn't even being talked about. That in itself is a narrative when the media doesn't want to cover a story. They're trying to take it out of the public eye. And that's a narrative in itself, a narrative of omission, you could say.
Definitely. So I think that word of the week is pretty on point for us. But that pretty much wraps up this episode of The Right Side. If you guys want to find full show notes for it, you can find that at rightsidenews.ca. You can also subscribe to us by going to rightsidenews.ca/iTunes or rightsidenews.ca/YouTube. And if you want to follow what we do during the week, our stories as we go, you can find us on social media Twitter and Facebook at RightsideCA. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And we will always give you all of the stories of the week without biases or sensationalism that the media will try and do, and we'll always give you the right side of the news. So with that, we will see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.